still. If that's the only way that I can get it, I accept.
I'm glad to hear it. The innkeeper relaxed into a half smile.
Come now, is 3 days really so unusual?
Chronicler's serious expression returned.
3 days is quite unusual. But then again,
some of the self-importance seemed to leak out of him.
Then again,
he made a gesture as if to show how useless words were.
You are, quoth.
The man who called himself Coat looked up from behind his bottles. A full-lipped smile played about his mouth. A spark was kindling behind his eyes. He seemed taller.
Yes, I suppose I am,
Quoth said, and his voice had iron in it.
Chapter 7 Of Beginnings and the Names of Things. Sunlight poured into the waystone. It was a cool, fresh light fitted for beginnings. It brushed past the miller as he set his water wheel turning for the day. It lit the forge the smith was rekindling after 4 days of cold metalwork. It touched draft horses, hitched to wagons, and sickle blades glittering sharp and ready at the beginning of an autumn day. Inside the waystone, the light fell across Chronicler's face and touched a beginning there, a blank page waiting the first words of a story. The light flowed across the bar, scattered 1,000 tiny rainbow beginnings from the coloured bottles and climbed the wall towards the sword, as if searching for one final beginning. But when the light touched the sword, there were no beginnings to be seen. In fact, the light the sword reflected was dull, burnished, and ages old. Looking at it, Chronicler remembered that, though it was the beginning of a day, it was also late autumn and growing colder. The sword shone with the knowledge that dawn was a small beginning compared to the ending of a season, the ending of a year. Chronicler pulled his eyes away from the sword, aware that Quoth had said something but not knowing what.
I beg your pardon? How do people normally go about relating their stories?
Quoth asked. Chronicler shrugged.
Most simply tell me what they remember. Later I record events in the proper order, remove the unnecessary pieces, clarify, simplify, that sort of thing.
Quoth frowned.
I don't think that will do.
Chronicler gave him a shy smile.
Storytellers are always different. They prefer their stories to be left alone, but they also prefer an attentive audience. I usually listen and record later. I have a nearly perfect memory. Nearly perfect. Doesn't quite suit me.
Quoth pressed a finger against his lips.
How fast can you write?
Chronicler gave a knowing smile.
Faster than a man can talk.
Quoth raised an eyebrow.
I'd like to see that.
Chronicler opened his satchel. He brought out a stack of fine white paper and a bottle of ink. After arranging them carefully, he dipped a pen and looked expectantly at Quoth. Quoth sat forward in his chair and spoke quickly.
I am, we are, she is, he was, they will be.
Chronicler's pen danced and scratched down the page as Quoth watched it.
I, Chronicler, do hereby avow that I can neither read nor write, supine, irreverent, jackdaw, quartz, lacquer, egollient, lintulu sorenhae. There was a young widow from Phaeton, whose morals were hard as a rock. She went to confession for her true obsession.
Quoth leaned farther forward to watch as Chronicler wrote.
Interesting. Oh, you may stop.
Chronicler smiled again and wiped his pen on a piece of cloth. The page in front of him held a single line of incomprehensible symbols.
Some sort of cipher?
Quoth wondered aloud.
Very neatly done, too. I'll bet you don't spoil many pages.
He turned the sheet to look at the writing more carefully.
I never spoil pages, Chronicler said haughtily.
Quoth nodded without looking up.
What does egollient mean?
Chronicler asked.
Hmm? Oh, nothing. I made it up. I wanted to see if an unfamiliar word would slow you down.
He stretched and pulled his chair closer to Chronicler's.
As soon as you show me how to read this, we can begin.
Chronicler looked doubtful.
It's a very complex... Seeing Quoth frown, he sighed. I'll try.
Chronicler drew a deep breath and began to write a line of symbols as he spoke.
There are around 50 different sounds we use to speak. I've given each of them a symbol consisting of one or two pen strokes. It's all sound. I could conceivably transcribe a language I don't even understand.
He pointed.
These are different vowel sounds.
All vertical lines,
Quoth said, looking intently at the page. Chronicler paused, thrown off his stride.
Well, yes.
The consonants would be horizontal then, and they would combine like this. Taking the pen, Quoth made a few marks of his own on the page.
Clever. You'd never need more than two or three for a word.
Chronicler watched Quoth quietly. Quoth didn't notice his attention on the paper.
If this is am, then these must be the ah sounds.
He motioned to a group of characters Chronicler had penned.
Ah, I, a, ow. That would make these the o's.
Quoth nodded to himself and pressed the pen back into Chronicler's hand.
Show me the consonants.
Chronicler penned them down numbly, reciting the sounds as he wrote. After a moment, Quoth took the pen and completed the list himself, asking the dumbfounded Chronicler to correct him if he made a mistake. Chronicler watched and listened as Quoth completed the list. From beginning to end, the whole process took about 15 minutes. He made no mistakes.
Wonderfully efficient system, Quoth said appreciatively. Very logical. Did you design it yourself?
Chronicler took a long moment before he spoke, staring at the rows of characters on the page in front of Quoth. Finally, disregarding Quoth's question, Chronicler asked,
Did you really learn Tamer in a day?
Quoth gave a faint smile and looked down at the table.
That's an old story. I'd almost forgotten. It took a day and a half, actually. A day and a half with no sleep. Why'd you ask?
I heard about it at the university. I never really believed it.
He looked down at the page of his cipher in Quoth's neat handwriting.
All of it?
Quoth looked puzzled.
What? Did you learn the whole language?
No, of course not,
Quoth said rather testily.
Only a portion of it. A large portion, to be sure, but I don't believe you can ever learn all of anything, let alone a language.
Quoth rubbed his hands together.
Now, are you ready?
Chronicler shook his head as if to clear it, set out a new sheet of paper, and nodded. Quoth held up a hand to keep Chronicler from writing and spoke.
I've never told this story before, and I doubt I'll ever tell it again.
Quoth leaned forward in his chair.
Before we begin, you must remember that I am of the Edemaru. We were telling stories before Kaluktena burned, before there were books to write in, before there was music to play. When the first fire kindled, we Ru were there spinning stories in the circle of its flickering light.
Quoth nodded to the scribe.
I know your reputation as a great collector of stories and recorder of events.
Quoth's eyes became hard as flint, sharp as broken glass.
That said, do not presume to change a word of what I say. If I seem to wander, if I seem to stray, remember that true stories seldom take the straightest way.
Chronicler nodded solemnly, trying to imagine the mind that could break apart his cipher in a piece of an hour, a mind that could learn a language in a day. Quoth gave a gentle smile and looked around the room as if fixing it in his memory. Chronicler dipped his pen, and Quoth looked down at his folded hands for as long as it takes to draw 3 deep breaths. Then he began to speak.
In some ways, it began when I heard her singing, a voice twinning, mixing with my own. Her voice was like a portrait of her soul. Wild as a fire, sharp as shattered glass, sweet and clean as clover.
Quoth shook his head.
No,
It began at the university. I went to learn magic of the sort they talk about in stories, magic like Taborlin the Great. I wanted to learn the name of the wind. I wanted fire and lightning. I wanted answers to 10,000 questions and access to their archives. But what I found at the university was much different than a story, and I was much dismayed. But I expect the true beginning lies in what led me to the university. Unexpected fires at twilight. A man with eyes like ice at the bottom of a well. The smell of blood and burning hair. The Chandrian.
He nodded to himself.
Yes. I suppose that is where it all begins. This is in many ways a story about the Chandrian.
Kvothe shook his head as if to free himself from some dark thought.
But I suppose I must go even further back than that. If this is to be something resembling my book of deeds, I can spare the time. It will be worth it if I am remembered, if not flatteringly, then at least with some small amount of accuracy. But what would my father say if he heard me telling a story this way? Begin at the beginning. Very well. If we are to have a telling, let's make it a proper one.
Kvothe sat forward in his chair.
In the beginning, as far as I know, the world was spun out of the nameless void by Arleth, who gave everything a name. Or, depending on the version of the tale, found the names all things already possess.
Chronicler let slip a small laugh, though he did not look up from his page or pause in his writing. Kvothe continued, smiling himself.
I see you laugh. Very well. For simplicity's sake, let us assume I am the center of creation. In doing this, let us pass over innumerable boring stories, the rise and fall of empires, sagas of heroism, ballads of tragic love. Let us hurry forward to the only tale of any real importance.
His smile broadened.
Mine. My name is Kvothe, pronounced nearly the same as Kvothe. Names are important, as they tell you a great deal about a person. I've had more names than anyone has a right to. The Ardem call me Medre, which, depending on how it's spoken, can mean the flame, the thunder, or the broken tree. The flame is obvious if you've ever seen me. I have red hair, bright. If I had been born a couple of hundred years ago, I would probably have been burned as a demon. I keep it short, but it's unruly. When left to its own devices, it sticks up and makes me look as if I have been set afire. The thunder, I attribute to a strong baritone and a great deal of stage training at an early age. I've never thought of the broken tree as very significant, although in retrospect I suppose it could be considered at least partially prophetic. My first mentor called me Elir, because I was clever, and I knew it. My first real lover called me Dulator, because she liked the sound of it. I have been called Shadikar, Lightfinger, and Sixstring. I have been called Kvothe the Bloodless, Kvothe the Arcane, and Kvothe Kingkiller. I have earned those names, bought and paid for them. But I was brought up as Kvothe. My father once told me it meant to know. I have, of course, been called many other things, most of them uncouth, although very few were unearned. I have stolen princesses back from sleeping barrow kings. I burned down the town of Trebon. I have spent the night with Felurian and left with both my sanity and my life. I was expelled from the university at a younger age than most people are allowed in. I tread paths by moonlight that others fear to speak of during day. I have talked to gods, loved women, and written songs that make the minstrels weep. You may have heard of me.
Chapter 8 Thieves, Heretics, and Whores.
If this story is to be something resembling my book of deeds, we must begin at the beginning, at the heart of who I truly am. To do this, you must remember that before I was anything else, I was one of the Edema Rue. Contrary to popular belief, not all traveling performers are of the Rue. My troupe was not some poor batch of mummers japing at crossroads for pennies singing for our suppers. We were court performers, Lord Greyfellow's men. Our arrival in most towns was more of an event than the midwinter pageantry and solenade games rolled together. There were usually at least 8 wagons in our troupe and well over 2 dozen performers, actors and acrobats, musicians and hand magicians, jugglers and jesters, my family. My father was a better actor and musician than any you have ever seen. My mother had a natural gift for words. They were both beautiful, with dark hair and easy laughter. They were Rue down to their bones, and that really is all that needs to be said. Save perhaps that my mother was a noble before she was a trooper. She told me my father had lured her away from a miserable, dreary hell with sweet music and sweeter words. I could only assume she meant 3 crossings where we went to visit relatives when I was very young, once. My parents were never really married, by which I mean they never bothered making their relationship official with any church. I'm not embarrassed by the fact. They considered themselves married and didn't see much point in announcing it to any government or God. I respect that. In truth, they seemed more content and faithful than many officially married couples I have seen since. Our patron was Baron Greyfallow, and his name opened many doors that would ordinarily be closed to the Edema Rue. In return, we wore his colors, green and gray, and added to his reputation wherever we went. Once a year, we spent 2 span at his manor, entertaining him and his household. It was a happy childhood, growing up in the center of an endless fair. My father would read to me from the great monologues during the long wagon rides between towns. Reciting mostly from memory, his voice would roll down the road for a quarter mile. I remember reading along, coming in on the secondary parts. My father would encourage me to try particularly good sections myself, and I learned to love the feel of good words. My mother and I would make up songs together. Other times, my parents would act out romantic dialogues while I followed along in the books. They seemed like games at the time. Little did I know how cunningly I was being taught. I was a curious child, quick with questions and eager to learn. With acrobats and actors as my teachers, it is little wonder that I never grew to dread lessons as most children do. The roads were safer in those days, but cautious folk would still travel with our troop for safety's sake. They supplemented my education. I learned an eclectic smattering of Commonwealth law from a traveling barrister too drunk or too pompous to realize he was lecturing an 8-year-old. I learned woodcraft from a huntsman named Lacklith, who traveled with us for nearly a whole season. I learned the sordid inner workings of the royal court in Mordeg from a courtesan. As my father used to say, call a jack a jack, call a spade, but always call a whore a lady. Their lives are hard enough, and it never hurts to be polite. Hetera smelled vaguely of cinnamon, and at 9 years old I found her fascinating without exactly knowing why. She taught me I should never do anything in private that I didn't want talked about in public, and cautioned me to not talk in my sleep. And then there was Abenthi, my first real teacher. He taught me more than all the others set end to end.
If not for him, I would never have become the man I am today. I ask that you not hold it against him. He meant well.
You'll have to move along, the mayor said. Camp outside town and no one will bother you so long as you don't start any fights or wander off with anything that isn't yours.
He gave my father a significant look.
Then be on your merry way tomorrow. No performances. They're more trouble than they're worth.
We are licensed, my father said, pulling out a folded piece of parchment from the inner pocket of his jacket. Charged to perform, in fact. The mayor shook his head and made no motion to look at our writ of patronage.
It makes folk rowdy, he said firmly. Last time there was an unholy row during the play. Too much drinking, too much excitement. Folks tore the doors off the public house and smashed up the tables. The hall belongs to the town, you see. The town bears the expense of the repairs.
By this time, our wagons were drawing attention. Trip was doing some juggling. Marion and his wife were putting on an impromptu string puppet show. I was watching my father from the back of our wagon.
We certainly would not want to offend you or your patron, the mayor said. However, the town can ill afford another evening such as that. As a gesture of goodwill, I'm willing to offer you a copper each, say 20 pennies, simply to be on your way and not make any trouble for us here.
Now, you have to understand that 20 pennies might be a good bit of money for some little ragamuffin troupe living hand to mouth, but for us, it was simply insulting. He should have offered us 40 to play for the evening, free use of the public hall, a good meal, and beds at the inn. The last we would graciously decline, as their beds were no doubt lousy, and those in our wagons were not. If my father was surprised or insulted, he did not show it.
Pack up,
he shouted over one shoulder. Trip tucked his juggling stones into various pockets without so much as a flourish. There was a disappointed chorus from several dozen townsfolk as the puppets stopped mid-jape and were packed away. The mayor looked relieved, brought out his purse and pulled out 2 silver pennies.
I'll be sure to tell the Baron of your generosity, my father said carefully as the mayor laid the pennies into his hand.
The mayor froze mid-motion.
Baron?
Baron Greyfellow. My father paused, looking for some spark of recognition on the mayor's face.
Lord of the Eastern Marshes, Hudumbrun by Tiren, and the Widdicond Hills.
My father looked around at the horizon.
We are still in the Widdicond Hills, aren't we?
Well, yes, the mayor said.
But Squire Semelan... Oh, we're in Semelan's fief, my father exclaimed, looking around as if just now getting his bearings. Thin gentleman? Tidy little beard?
He brushed his chin with his fingers.
The mayor nodded numbly. Charming fellow, lovely singing voice. Met him when we were entertaining the Baron last midwinter. Of course, the mayor paused significantly. Might I see your writ?
I watched as the mayor read it. It took him a little while, as my father had not bothered to mention the majority of the Baron's titles, such as the Viscount of Montrone and Lord of Trelliston. The upshot was this. It was true that the Squire Semelan controlled this little town and all the land around it, but Semelan owed fealty directly to Greyfellow. In more concrete terms, Greyfellow was captain of the ship. Semelan scrubbed the planking and saluted him. The mayor refolded the parchment and handed it back to my father.
I see.
That was all. I remember being stunned when the mayor didn't apologize or offer my father more money. My father paused as well, then continued.
The city is your jurisdiction, sir, but we'll perform either way. It will either be here or just outside the city limits. You can't use a public house, the mayor said firmly. I won't have it wrecked again. We can play right here.
My father pointed to the market square. It will be enough space and it keeps everyone right here in town. The mayor hesitated, though I could hardly believe it.
We sometimes chose to play on the green because the local buildings weren't big enough. Two of our wagons were built to become stages for just that eventuality, but in my whole 11 years of memory, I could barely count on both hands the times we'd been forced to play the green. We had never played outside the city limits. But we were spared that. The mayor nodded at last and gestured my father closer. I slipped out the back of the wagon and moved close enough to catch the end of what he said. God-fearing folk around here, nothing vulgar or heretical. We had a double handful of trouble with the last troop that came through here. 2 fights, folks missing their laundry, and one of Branston's daughters got herself in a family way. I was outraged. I waited for my father to show the mayor the sharp side of his tongue, to explain the difference between mere travelling performers and Edema Rue. We didn't steal. We would never let things get so out of control that a bunch of drunks ruined the hall where we were playing. But my father did nothing of the sort. He just nodded and walked back toward our wagon. He gestured, and Trip started juggling again. The puppets re-emerged from their cases. As he came around the wagon, he saw me standing, half hidden beside the horses.
"I'm guessing you heard the whole thing from the look on your face,"
he said with a wry grin.
"Let it go, my boy. He gets full marks for honesty, if not for grace. He just says out loud what other folk keep in the quiet of their hearts. Why do you think I have everyone stay in pairs when we go about our business in bigger towns?"
I knew it for the truth. Still, it was a hard pill for a young boy to swallow.
20 pennies,
I said scathingly.
"As if he were offering us charity."
That was the hardest part of growing up Edema Rue. We are strangers everywhere. Many folk view us as vagabonds and beggars, while others deem us little more than thieves, heretics, and whores. It's hard to be wrongfully accused, but it's worse when the people looking down on you are clods who have never read a book or travelled more than 20 miles from the place they were born. My father laughed and ruffed my hair.
"Just pity him, my boy. Tomorrow we'll be on our way, but he'll have to keep his own disagreeable company until the day he dies."
"He's an ignorant blatherskate,"
I said bitterly. He lay a firm hand on my shoulder, letting me know I'd said enough.
"This is what comes of getting too close to Artor, I suppose. Tomorrow we'll head south, greener pastures, kinder folk, prettier women."
He cupped an ear toward the wagon and nudged me with his elbow.
"I can hear everything you say,"
my mother called sweetly from inside. My father grinned and winked at me.
"So what play are we going to do?"
I asked my father.
"Nothing vulgar, mind you, they're God-fearing folk in these parts."
He looked at me. "What would you pick?" I gave it a long moment's thought.
"I'd play something from the Bright Field cycle, The Forging of the Path or some such."
My father made a face.
"Not a very good play."
I shrugged.
"They won't know the difference. Besides, it's chock full of tailu, and no one will complain about it being vulgar."
I looked up at the sky.
"I just hope it doesn't rain on us halfway through."
My father looked up at the clouds.
"It will. Still, there are worse things than playing in the rain."
"Like playing in the rain and getting shimmed on the deal?"
I asked. The mayor hurried up to us, moving at a fast walk. There was a thin sheen of sweat on his forehead, and he was puffing a little bit, as if he'd been running.
"I talked it over with a few members of the council, and we decided that it would be quite all right for you to use the public house, if you would care to."
My father's body language was perfect. It was perfectly clear he was offended, but far too polite to say anything.
"I certainly wouldn't want to put you out."
"No, no, no bother at all. I insist, in fact."
"Very well, if you insist."
The mayor smiled and hurried away.
"Well, that's a little better,"
my father sighed.
"No need to tighten our belts yet."
Ha'penny a head, that's right. Anyone without a head gets in free, thank you, sir.
Trip was working the door, making sure everyone paid to see the play.
Ha'penny a head, though by the rosy glow in your lady's cheeks, I should be charging you for a head and a half. Not that it's any of my business, mind you.
Trip had the quickest tongue of anyone in the troupe, which made him the best man for the job of making sure no one tried to fast-talk or bully their way inside. Wearing his green and grey jester's motley, Trip could say just about anything and get away with it.
"Hello, Mum. No charge for the little one, but if he starts to squawk, you'd best give him the tit quick or take him outside."
Trip carried on his unending patter.
"That's right, Ha'penny. Yes, sir. Empty head still pays full price. Hoo-hoo!"
Though it was always fun to watch Trip work, most of my attention was on a wagon that had rolled into the other end of town about a quarter hour ago. The mayor had argued with the old man driving it, then stormed off. Now I saw the mayor heading back to the wagon accompanied by a tall fellow carrying a long cudgel, the constable, unless I missed my guess. My curiosity got the best of me, and I made my way towards the wagon, doing my best to stay out of sight. The mayor and the old man were arguing again by the time I got close enough to hear. The constable stood nearby, looking irritated and anxious.
"Told you. I don't have a license. I don't need a license. Does a peddler need a license? Does a tinker need a license?"
"You're not a tinker," the mayor said. "Don't try to pass yourself off as one."
"I'm not trying to pass myself off as anything,"
the old man snapped.
"I'm a tinker and a peddler, and I'm more than both. I'm an arcanist, you great dithering heap of idiot."
"My point exactly," the mayor said doggedly. "We're God-fearing people in these parts. We don't want any meddling with dark things better left alone. We don't want the trouble your kind can bring."
"My kind?" the old man said. "What do you know about my kind? There probably hasn't been an arcanist through these parts in 50 years.
"We like it that way. Just turn around and go back the way you came."
"Like hell if I'm spending a night in the rain because of your thick head,"
the old man said hotly.
"I don't need your permission to rent a room or do business in the street. Now get away from me and I'll show you firsthand what sort of trouble my kind can be."
Fear flashed across the mayor's face before it was overwhelmed by outrage. He gestured over one shoulder at the constable.
"Then you'll spend the night in jail for vagrancy and threatening behaviour. We'll let you on your way in the morning if you've learned to keep a civil tongue in your head."
The constable advanced on the wagon, his cudgel held cautiously at his side. The old man stood his ground and raised one hand. A deep red light welled up from the front corners of his wagon.
"That's far enough," he said ominously. "Things could get ugly otherwise."
After a moment's surprise, I realized the strange light came from a pair of sympathy lamps the old man had mounted on his wagon. I had seen one before in Lord Greyfellow's library. They were brighter than gaslight, steadier than candles or lamps, and lasted nearly forever. They were also terribly expensive. I was willing to bet that no one in this little town had ever heard of them, let alone seen one. The constable stopped in his tracks when the light began to swell, but when nothing else seemed to happen, he set his jaw and kept walking toward the wagon. The old man's expression grew anxious.
"Now hold on a moment,"
he said as the red light from the wagon started to fade.
"We don't want—"
"Shut your clipper, you old shitfire,"
the constable said. He snatched at the arcanist's arm as if he were sticking his hand into an oven. Then, when nothing happened, he smiled and grew more confident.
"Don't think I won't knock you a good one to keep you from working any more of your devilry." "Well done, Tom," the mayor said, radiating relief. "Bring him along and we'll send someone back for the wagon."
The constable grinned and twisted the old man's arm. The arcanist bent at the waist and gasped a short, painful breath. From where I hid, I saw the arcanist's face change from anxious to pained to angry all in a second. I saw his mouth move. A furious gust of wind came out of nowhere, as if a storm had suddenly burst with no warning. The The wind struck the old man's wagon, and it tipped onto two wheels before slamming back down onto four. The constable staggered and fell as if he had been struck by the hand of God. Even where I hid, nearly 30 feet away, the wind was so strong that I was forced to take a step forward, as if I'd been pushed roughly from behind.
"Be gone!" the old man shouted angrily. "Trouble me no longer! I will set fire to your blood and fill you with the fear like ice and iron!"
There was something familiar about his words, but I couldn't put my finger on it.
Both the mayor and the constable turned tail and ran, their eyes white and wild as startled horses. The wind faded as quickly as it had come. The whole sudden burst couldn't have lasted more than 5 seconds. As most of the townsfolk were gathered around the public house, I doubted anyone had seen it except for me, the mayor, the constable, and the old man's donkeys, who stood placidly in their harness, utterly unperturbed.
"Leave this place clean of your foul presence,"
the arcanist muttered to himself as he watched them go. I finally realized why his words seemed so familiar. He was quoting lines from the exorcism scene in Deonica. Not many folk knew that play. The old man turned back to his wagon and began to extemporize.
"I'll turn you into butter on a summer day. I'll turn you into a poet with the soul of a priest. I'll fill you with lemon custard and push you out a window," he spat. "Bastards!"
His irritation seemed to leave him, and he heaved a great weary sigh.
"Well, that couldn't have gone much worse,"
the old man muttered as he rubbed at the shoulder of the arm the constable had twisted.
"Do you think they'll come back with a mob behind them?"
For a second, I thought the old man was talking to me. Then I realized the truth. He was talking to his donkeys.
"I don't think so either," he said to them. "But I've been wrong before. Let's stay near the edge of town and have a look at the last of the oats, shall we?"
He clambered up into the back of the wagon and came down with a wide bucket and a nearly empty burlap sack. He upended the sack into the bucket and seemed disheartened by the results. He took out a handful for himself before nudging the bucket toward the donkeys with his foot.
"Don't give me that look," he said to them. "It's short rations all around. Besides, you can graze."
He petted one donkey while he ate his handful of rough oats, stopping occasionally to spit out a husk. It struck me as very sad, this old man all alone on the road with no one to talk to but his donkeys. "It's hard for us," said Dame Roo, "but at least we had each other." This man had no one.
"We've wandered too far from civilization, boys. The folk that need me don't trust me, and the ones that trust me can't afford me."
The old man peered into his purse.
"We've got a penny and a half, so our options are limited. Do we want to be wet tonight or hungry tomorrow? We're not going to do any business, so it will probably be one or the other."
I slunk around the edge of the building until I could see what was written on the side of the old man's wagon. It read, "Abenthi, Arcanist Extraordinary, Scribe, Dowser, Chemist, Dentist, Rare Goods, All Ailments Tended, Lost Items Found, Anything Mended, No Horoscopes, No Love Potions, No Malefaction." Abenthi noticed me as soon as I stepped out from behind the building where I'd been hiding.
"Hello there. Can I help you?"
"You've misspelt ailments," I pointed out.
He looked surprised.
"It's a joke, actually,"
he explained.
"I brew a bit."
"Oh, ale," I said, nodding. "I get it."
I brought my hand out of my pocket.
"Can you sell me anything for a penny?"
He seemed stuck between amusement and curiosity.
"What are you looking for?"
"I'd like some Lucilium."
We had performed Farion the Fair 12 times in the last month, and it had filled my young mind with intrigue and assassination.
"Are you expecting someone to poison you?"
he said, somewhat taken aback.
"Not really. But it seems to me that if you wait around until you know you need an antidote, it's probably too late to pick one up.
I suppose I could sell you a penny's worth, he said. That would be about a dose for a person your size. But it's dangerous stuff in its own right. It only cures certain poisons. You can hurt yourself if you take it at the wrong time.
Oh, I said. I didn't know that.
In the play it was touted as an infallible cure-all. Abenthy tapped his lips thoughtfully.
Can you answer me a question in the meantime?
I nodded.
Whose trope is that?
In a way it's mine, I said. But in another way it's my father's, because he runs the show and points which way the wagons go. But it's Baron Greyfellow's too, because he's our patron. We're Lord Greyfellow's men.
The old man gave me an amused look.
I've heard of you. Good troupe. Good reputation.
I nodded, not seeing any point in false modesty.
Do you think your father might be interested in taking on any help?
He asked.
I don't claim to be much of an actor, but I'm handy to have around. I could make you face paint and rouge that aren't all full of lead and mercury and arsenic. I can do lights too, quick, clean and bright, different colours if you want them.
I didn't have to think too hard about it. Candles were expensive and vulnerable to draughts, torches were dirty and dangerous, and everyone in the troupe learned the dangers of cosmetics at an early age. It was hard to become an old, seasoned trooper when you painted poison on yourself every third day and ended up raving mad by the time you were 25.
I may be overstepping myself a little, I said as I held out my hand for him to shake, but let me be the first to welcome you to the troop.
If this is to be a full and honest account of my life and deeds, I feel I should mention that my reasons for inviting Ben into our troop were not entirely altruistic. It's true that quality cosmetics and clean lights were a welcome addition to our troop. It's also true that I'd felt sorry for the old man alone on the road. But underneath it all, I was moved by my curiosity. I had seen Abenthy do something I could not explain. Something strange and wonderful. Not his trick with the sympathy lamps, I recognized that for what it was, showmanship, a bluff to impress ignorant townsfolk. What he had done afterwards was different. He called the wind, and the wind came. It was magic, real magic, the sort of magic I'd heard about in stories of Taborin the Great, the sort of magic I hadn't believed in since I was 6. Now I didn't know what to believe. So I invited him into our troop, hoping to find answers to my questions. Though I didn't know it at the time, I was looking for the name of the wind.
Chapter 9. Riding in the Wagon with Ben. Abenthy was the first arcanist I ever met, a strange, exciting figure to a young boy. He was knowledgeable in all the sciences, botany, astronomy, psychology, anatomy, alchemy, geology, chemistry. He was portly, with twinkling eyes that moved quickly from one thing to another. He had a strip of dark grey hair running around the back of his head, but, and this is what I remember most about him, no eyebrows. Rather, he had them, but they were in a perpetual state of regrowing from being burned off in the course of his alchemical pursuits. It made him look surprised and quizzical all at once. He spoke gently, laughed often, and never exercised his wit at the expense of others. He cursed like a drunken sailor with a broken leg, but only at his donkeys. They were called Alpha and Beta, and Abenthy fed them carrots and lumps of sugar when he thought no one was looking. Chemistry was his particular love, and my father said he'd never known a man to run a better still. By his second day in our troop, I was making a habit of riding in his wagon. I would ask him questions, and he would answer. Then he would ask for songs, and I would pluck them out for him on a lute I borrowed from my father's wagon. He would even sing from time to time. He had a bright, reckless tenor that was always wandering off, looking for notes in the wrong places. More often than not, he stopped and laughed at himself when it happened. He was a good man, and there was no conceit in him. Not long after he joined our troop, I asked Abenthy what it was like being an arcanist. He gave me a thoughtful look.
Have you ever known an arcanist?
We paid one to mend a cracked axle on the road once.
I paused to think.
He was heading inland with a caravan of fish.
Abenthy made a dismissive gesture.
No, boy, I'm talking about arcanists, not some poor chill charmer who works his way back and forth across caravan routes trying to keep fresh meat from rotting.
What's the difference?
I asked, sensing it was expected of me.
Well, he said, that might take a bit of explaining. I've got nothing but time.
Abenthy gave me an appraising look. I'd been waiting for it. It was the look that said, "You don't sound as young as you look." I hoped he'd come to grips with it fairly soon. It gets tiresome being spoken to as if you were a child, even if you happen to be one. He took a deep breath.
Just because someone knows a trick or two doesn't mean they're an arcanist. They might know how to set a bone, or read Eld Vintic. Maybe they even know a little sympathy, but...
Sympathy?
I interrupted as politely as possible.
You'd probably call it magic,
Abenthy said reluctantly.
It's not, really.
He shrugged.
But even knowing sympathy doesn't make you an arcanist. A true arcanist has worked his way through the arcanum at the university.
At his mention of the arcanum, I bristled with 2 dozen new questions. Not so many, you might think, but when you added them to the 50 questions I carried with me wherever I went, I was stretched nearly to bursting. Only through a severe effort of will did I remain silent, waiting for Abenthy to continue on his own. Abenthy, however, noticed my reaction.
So you've heard about the Arcanum, have you?
He seemed amused.
Tell me what you've heard, then.
This small prompt was all the excuse I needed.
I heard from a boy in Temper Glen that if your arm's cut off, they can sew it back on at the university. Can they really? Some stories say Tabal in the Great went there to learn the names of all things. There's a library with 1,000 books. Are there really that many?
He answered the last question, the others having rushed by too quickly for him to respond.
More than 1,000, actually. 10 times 10,000 books, more than that, more books than you could ever read.
Abenthy's voice grew vaguely wistful. More books than I could read? Somehow I doubted that. Ben continued.
The people you see riding with caravans, charmers who keep food from spoiling, dowsers, fortune-tellers, toad-eaters, aren't real arcanists any more than all travelling performers are a Demaru. They might know a little alchemy, a little sympathy, a little medicine.
He shook his head.
But they're not arcanists. A lot of people pretend to be. They wear robes and put on airs to take advantage of the ignorant and gullible. But here's how you tell a true arcanist.
Abenthy pulled a fine chain over his head and handed it to me. It was the first time I had ever seen an arcanum guilder. It looked rather unimpressive, just a flat piece of lead with some unfamiliar writing stamped onto it.
That is a true guilder, or guilder, if you prefer,
Abenthy explained with some satisfaction.
It's the only sure way to be certain of who is and who isn't an arcanist. Your father asked to see mine before he let me ride with your troop. It shows he's a man of the words.
He watched me with a sly disinterest.
Uncomfortable, isn't it?
I gritted my teeth and nodded. My hand had gone numb as soon as I'd touched it. I was curious to study the markings on its front and back, but after the space of 2 breaths, my arm was numb to the shoulder, as if I had slept on it all night. I wondered if my whole body would go numb if I held it long enough. I was prevented from finding out as the wagon hit a bump, and my numbed hand almost let Abenthes Gilder fall to the footboard of the wagon. He snatched it up and slipped it back over his head, chuckling.
How can you stand it?
I asked, trying to rub a little feeling back into my hand.
It only feels that way to other people, he explained. To its owner, it's just warm. That's how you can tell the difference between an arcanist and someone who has a knack for finding water or guessing at the weather.
Trip has something like that, I said. He rolls 7s.
Oh, that's a little different, Abenthy laughed. Not anything so unexplainable as a knack.
He slouched a little farther down into his seat.
Probably for the best. A couple of 100 years ago, a person was as good as dead if folk saw he had a knack. The Talins called them demon signs, and burned folk if they had them.
Abenthy's mood seemed to have taken a downward turn.
We had to break Trip out of jail once or twice, I said, trying to lighten the tone of the conversation. But no one actually tried to burn him.
Abenthy gave a tired smile.
I suspect Trip has a pair of clever dice or an equally clever skill, which probably extends to cards as well. I thank you for your timely warning, but a knack is something else entirely.
I can't abide being patronized.
Trip can't cheat to save his life, I said a little more sharply than I had intended. And anyone in the troop can tell good dice from bad. Trip throws 7s. It doesn't matter whose dice he uses, he rolls 7s. If he bets on someone, they roll 7s. If he so much as bumps a table with loose dice on it, 7.
Abenthy nodded to himself.
My apologies. That does sound like a knack. I'd be curious to see it.
I nodded.
Take your own dice. We haven't let him play for years.
A thought occurred to me.
It might not still work.
He shrugged.
Knacks don't go away so easily as that. When I was growing up in Staup, I knew a young man with a knack, uncommonly good with plants.
Abenthy's grin was gone as he looked off at something I couldn't see.
His tomatoes would be red while everyone else's vines were still climbing. His squash were bigger and sweeter. His grapes didn't hardly have to be bottled before they started being wine.
He trailed off, his eyes far away.
Did they burn him?
I asked with a morbid curiosity of the young.
What? No, of course not. I'm not that old.
He scowled at me in mock severity.
There was a drought and he got run out of town. His poor mother was heartbroken.
There was a moment of silence. 2 wagons ahead of us. I heard Terran and Shandy rehearsing lines from The Swineherd and the Nightingale. Abenthy seemed to be listening as well, in an offhand way. After Terran got himself lost halfway through Fane's garden monologue, I turned back to face him.
Do they teach acting at the university?
I asked. Abenthy shook his head, slightly amused by the question.
Many things, but not that.
I looked over at Abenthy and saw him watching me. His eyes danced.
Could you teach me some of those other things?
I asked. He smiled, and it was as easy as that. Abenthy proceeded to give me a brief overview of each of the sciences. While his main love was for chemistry, he believed in a rounded education. I learned how to work the sextant, the compass, the slipstick, the abacus. More important, I learned to do without. Within a span, I could identify any chemical in his cart. In 2 months, I could distill liquor until it was too strong to drink, bandage a wound, set a bone, and diagnose hundreds of sicknesses from symptoms. I knew the process for making 4 different aphrodisiacs,
3 concoctions for contraception, 9 for impotence, and 2 filters referred to simply as Maiden's Helper. Abenthy was rather vague about the purpose of the last of these, but I had some strong suspicions. I learned the formulae for 12 poisons and acids and 100 medicines and cure-alls, some of which even worked. I doubled my herb lore in theory, if not in practice. Abenthy started to call me Red, and I called him Ben, first in retaliation, then in friendship. Only now, far after the fact, do I recognize how carefully Ben prepared me for what was to come at the university. He did it subtly. Once or twice a day, mixed in with my normal lectures, Ben would present me with a little mental exercise I would have to master before we went on to anything else. He made me play Tirani without a board, keeping track of the stones in my head. Other times he would stop in the middle of a conversation and make me repeat everything said in the last few minutes, word for word. This was levels beyond the simple memorization I had practiced for the stage. My mind was learning to work in different ways, becoming stronger. It felt the same way your body feels after a day of splitting wood or swimming or sex. You feel exhausted, languorous, and almost godlike. This feeling was similar, except it was my intellect that was weary and expanded, languid and latently powerful. I could feel my mind starting to awaken. I seemed to gain momentum as I progressed, like when water starts to wash away a dam made of sand. I don't know if you understand what a geometric progression is, but that is the best way to describe it. Through it all, Ben continued to teach me mental exercises that I was half convinced he constructed out of sheer meanness. Chapter 10. Alar and Several Stones. Ben held up a chunk of dirty field stone slightly bigger than his fist.
What will happen if I let go of this rock?
I thought for a bit. Simple questions during lesson time were very seldom simple. Finally, I gave the obvious answer.
It will probably fall.
He raised an eyebrow. I had kept him busy over the last several months, and he hadn't had the leisure to accidentally burn them off.
Probably. You sound like a sophist, boy. Hasn't it always fallen before?
I stuck my tongue out at him.
Don't try to bold-face your way through this one. That's a fallacy. You taught me that yourself.
He grinned.
Fine. Would it be fair to say you believe it will fall?
Fair enough.
I want you to believe it will fall up when I let go of it.
His grin widened. I tried. It was like doing mental gymnastics. After a while, I nodded.
Okay.
How well do you believe it?
Not very well,
I admitted.
I want you to believe this rock will float away. Believe it with a faith that will move mountains and shake trees.
He paused and seemed to take a different tack.
Do you believe in God?
Telu? After a fashion?
Not good enough. Do you believe in your parents?
I gave a little smile.
Sometimes. I can't see them right now.
He snorted and unhooked the slapstick he used to goad Alpha and Beta when they were being lazy.
Do you believe in this, Elir?
He only called me Elir when he thought I was being especially willfully obstinate. He held out the stick for my inspection. There was a malicious glitter in his eye. I decided not to tempt fate.
Yes.
Good.
He slapped the side of the wagon with it, producing a sharp crack. One of Alpha's ears pivoted around at the noise, uncertain as to whether or not it was directed at her.
That's the sort of belief I want. It's called Alar, riding crop belief. When I drop this stone, it will float.